Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson. And today, well, we've got quite a task ahead of us.
We certainly do. Hi, everyone. I'm Sam Kennedy. The sheer volume of source material we've got here, it covers pretty much every reported action from the U.S. federal government starting October 28th, 2025.
It does. And our mission, yours and mine, is to give you, our listeners, a really comprehensive, granular, almost exhaustive report on all that activity. We're calling this Deep Dive, the federal news update for Wednesday, October 29th, 2025.
Yeah, and you know, as we dug into all this, one theme just jumped out. It was, well, unavoidable, really. On one hand, you have this picture of complete domestic paralysis, the government shutdown being used as a weapon.
Right, total gridlocked.
But then, simultaneously, you see this incredibly aggressive, unilateral executive action happening on the global stage. It's like,
yeah,
like a dual-track presidency, full speed ahead internationally, completely stalled at home, intentionally, it seems.
That contrast is really something. Let's start with that paralysis. The shutdown. Day 28 now, the main event, the thing really setting the mood domestically. Happened again in the Senate yesterday.
Absolutely. Mid-morning, 11.34 a.m. Eastern, we saw the 13th failed vote trying to break this logjam. They were trying to invoke cloture.
Which is just the fancy term for ending debate so they can actually vote on the bill itself, right?
Exactly. On the motion to proceed to H.R. 5371, that's the Republican-backed funding bill, the Continuing Appropriations and Extensions Act for 2026.
And, surprise, surprise, 13th time unlucky, failed 54 to 45. That vote count says it all, really.
It does. You've got a simple majority for it, 54 votes.
Mm-hmm.
But you need 60 to break that filibuster to get cloture. And Democrats are holding firm, blocking this continuing resolution, the CR.
And it's not just about the funding level itself. They're blocking it because of what's not in it.
Precisely. They want two key policy items included. First, they insist on funding for subsidies for the Affordable Care Act health plans. Without those, millions could face huge premium hikes.
Okay, so ACA subsidies, that's one. What's the second?
The second is about stopping the administration from carrying out these mass layoffs, RIFs, reductions in force, and also making deep policy cuts while the government's shut down. Democrats see this CR vote as their leverage point to stop what they argue are politically motivated moves by the administration.
So the CR isn't just a stopgap anymore. It's become, it's fully weaponized now, hasn't it? A tool to force policy concessions rather than find common ground.
Completely. And the most immediate and frankly devastating consequence of using the shutdown this way is this looming SNAP crisis.
Right. This is where it gets really tangible and frankly quite scary.
It is. On October 28th, the USDA, led by Secretary Brooke Rollins, confirmed it. They are suspending all Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program benefits, SNAP, nationwide.
All of them. And that suspension kicks in when?
November 1st, 2025, just days away. The official reason, the lapse in appropriations because of the shutdown.
The numbers involved here are just hard to wrap your head around.
They're staggering. Nearly 42 million Americans could lose their food assistance. And these aren't abstract numbers. Our sources point to specifics, like 5.5 million people in California alone.
Wow.
And think about Minnesota, over 180,000 children, plus nearly 70,000 seniors. They're facing an immediate food cliff.
But hang on, this isn't just a case of the money running out because of the shutdown clock.
Yeah.
There was a way to avoid this, wasn't there? The USDA itself said so earlier.
That's the absolute core of a controversy here. It feels manufactured. The USDA had put out guidance back on September 30th,
yeah.
And in that guidance, they basically said Congress had made its intent clear. There's a contingency fund, a $6 billion multi-year fund, specifically set up by Congress for exactly this kind of emergency. The USDA said they could legally use it.
So they had the money legally available set aside for this very purpose.
Correct. And then just days before this announcement, they issued a new memo completely reversing that position. Now they argue they cannot legally tap that $6 billion contingency fund.
A complete 180.
Total reversal. And the implication, as you said, it's hard to ignore. It looks like a deliberate choice to use hunger as political leverage rather than using the funds Congress explicitly provided. Political coercion over administrative duty.
And they didn't just reverse the policy quietly. They launched a messaging campaign alongside it.
Oh, yeah. It was blatant. Official government websites, whitehouse.gov, usda.gov, suddenly had these big banners, running clocks, counting down to the cutoff, explicitly blaming the Democrat shutdown.
So using government resources for purely partisan messaging during a crisis.
It absolutely blurred that line. Leveraging the threat of widespread hunger to put maximum political pressure on Democrats, it's pretty stark.
And meanwhile, the federal workers caught in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
The financial strain is becoming acute. Most civilian employees missed their first full paycheck last Friday.
Yeah, you saw Everett Kelly, the president of AFGE, the main federal employee union, put out this urgent call. He just said, look, pass a clean continuing resolution now.
No policy writers, just fund the government.
Exactly. His point was, the political points have been made. Stop the games, pay the people who are showing up, doing their jobs, often essential jobs, without pay.
And the situation for the military seems, if anything, even more uncertain. Vice President Vance made a statement.
He did. He said the administration believes they can continue paying the troops, at least for now. But how? They didn't specify the mechanism.
Right. At least for now isn't exactly reassuring.
Not at all. We know earlier this month they moved $8 billion from military R&D accounts just to cover payroll. That's robbing future readiness for present needs. But even with that shuffle, the pay system itself seems to be breaking down.
You mentioned chaos. Let's get into those details because they're pretty specific in our sources.
Yeah, the granular level shows real dysfunction. We're talking about 55 military families who just received no pay at all. Zero.
Just nothing.
Nothing. Then you have 50 service members who were overpaid, sometimes double or triple their normal paycheck. Which sounds good, maybe, until you realize they'll have to pay it back later, creating a whole new financial headache.
Okay, so no pay, overpay.
And maybe the weirdest one, 12 families whose official pay stubs, their earnings statements, looked perfectly normal, showed the right amount, right pay date, but the money just never hit their bank accounts.
So the system itself is generating conflicting information. Pay stubs say one thing, bank accounts another. Total uncertainty for thousands of families.
Precisely. And that kind of instability, that financial stress, it doesn't stay contained. It's spilling over into critical public services. Air travel, for example.
How so?
Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy reported serious flight delays nationwide. He specifically said that last Sunday, 44%, nearly half of all delays were linked directly to staffing shortages.
And these are the essential workers, like air traffic controllers.
Yes. They have to work, by law. But they're not getting paid, so what are they doing? Our sources say they're looking for side gigs, driving for Uber, delivering for DoorDash, just trying to make ends meet.
Having your air traffic controllers distracted by whether they can pay their rent. That doesn't sound good for safety.
It's a huge risk to the system. And then you get these almost bizarre bureaucratic glitches on top of it all, like at the FDA.
What happened there?
Apparently 7,000 FDA employees were mistakenly coded as furloughed in the payroll system. Even some who were deemed essential, who were working and should have been paid, they missed their paychecks too.
It's just a cascade, isn't it? The basic machinery of government starting to seize up.
It really is. Collateral damage from this political standoff. And it leads us right into the next major area, the legal and judicial front, where some of this executive power is being challenged.
Okay, so let's pivot to the courts, starting with a significant pushback against those mass layoffs, the RIFs we mentioned earlier.
Yes, a major development here. U.S. District Court Judge Susan Ilston issued a preliminary injunction. It indefinitely blocks the administration from sending out or implementing any more RAF notices linked to the shutdown. This affects about 4,000 federal employees, at least for now.
And her reasoning was pretty pointed, wasn't it? Not just procedural.
No, not at all. Judge Ilston explicitly said the RAFs appeared to be driven by political retribution. She even cited the president's own public statements about targeting specific agencies he disagreed with.
So the administration was arguing the shutdown forced these layoffs.
Essentially, yes. But the judge basically said the timing and targeting suggested the shutdown was being used as a pretext for permanent, politically motivated cuts, not just a temporary measure.
And what was the core legal argument from the unions challenging this?
Their lawyers made two key points. First, that carrying out mass layoffs isn't essential for protecting life or property, the usual standard for what continues during a shutdown. Second, and maybe more fundamentally, that you can't permanently eliminate positions through a RIF without specific authorization from Congress to do so. The administration can't just decide to downsize the government unilaterally using the shutdown as cover.
While the DOJ lawyers were arguing that the shutdown required more RIFs.
Bizarrely, yes. They argued the lack of appropriations compelled them to make cuts. But the unions pointed out, and the judge seemed to agree, that the timing was very suspicious.
How so?
Well, take the Interior Department. They apparently had RAF notices ready for over 2,000 employees for months, but they waited until the shutdown actually started to issue them.
Suggesting it wasn't about the immediate lack of funds, but using the shutdown opportunistically.
Exactly. So this injunction is a significant check, limiting the executive's ability to use this shutdown to fundamentally reshape the federal workforce without congressional approval.
Okay, so that's one major legal battle. The other big one that erupted immediately was over that SNAP cutoff.
Right. We talked about the USDA reversing its decision on the contingency fund. Well, almost immediately after that announcement, a coalition formed. 22 state attorneys general plus 3 governors filed a major lawsuit.
Where did they file?
Federal court in Massachusetts. They're suing the USDA and Secretary Rawlins directly.
And what are they asking the court for?
They're seeking an immediate temporary restraining order, a TRO, to block that November 1st cutoff of SNAP benefits. Their central legal argument hinges on the Administrative Procedure Act, the APA.
Okay, refresh us quickly. Why the APA?
The APA governs how federal agencies make rules and change policies. It requires agencies to provide a reasoned explanation for their actions and prevents them from making decisions that are arbitrary and capricious.
So the states are arguing the USDA's reversal on using the $6 billion fund was arbitrary and capricious.
Precisely. They're saying the USDA offered no real legal or administrative justification for suddenly deciding it couldn't use funds Congress clearly intended for this exact situation. The implication is the reversal was purely political, designed to inflict pain and pressure Congress.
This feels like a major states' rights challenge, really. Positioning the states as the last line of defense against the executive branch, weaponizing the social safety net.
It absolutely is. You saw Governor Newsom of California, who was part of the lawsuit, also announced state action fast-tracking $80 million in state money for food banks. States are preparing for the worst while fighting the federal decision in court.
Okay, moving from SMP to another constitutional flashpoint, this $230 million emoluments issue.
Yes. This escalated significantly. House Judiciary Democrats sent a very strongly worded formal letter to the top leadership at the Department of Justice.
Demanding what?
Demanding they flat out reject President Trump's request for the government to pay him roughly $230 million to cover his personal legal fees from past investigations and lawsuits.
And their argument rests on the Constitution itself.
Directly on the Domestic Emoluments Clause. That clause prohibits the president from receiving any compensation from the federal government beyond his official salary. The Democrats argue this $230 million payment would be a clear violation.
But the really explosive part seems to be who at DOJ would have to approve this payment.
Right. This is where it gets incredibly problematic. The letter points out what they call an unwaivable ethical conflict. Meaning the two senior DOJ officials who would normally have the authority to sign off on such a massive payout. Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche and Associate Attorney General Stanley Woodward were previously President Trump's personal criminal defense lawyers.
In the very cases he's now seeking government reimbursement for.
Exactly. You couldn't make it up. They represented him in the matters for which he now wants taxpayers to foot the $230 million bill.
That's staggering.
It is. The Democrats are demanding their immediate recusal, and they're warning that if Blanche and Woodward do approve this payment, they themselves could face potential criminal charges for violating ethics laws. It puts DOJ leadership in an absolutely impossible bind.
Okay, one more big legal fight. This one at the highest level, the Supreme Court. They're considering a major case about presidential power and tariffs.
Yes. This is the landmark case, Learning Resources, Inc. v. Trump. It's a direct challenge to the president's authority to impose broad tariffs unilaterally.
And the administration's justification for these tariffs rests on which law?
They're relying heavily on the International Emergency Economic Powers Act of 1977, known as IEPA.
IEPA. That's the law allowing the president to regulate international commerce if there's a declared national emergency.
Yes, it's the one. But the companies challenging the tariffs, and many legal scholars, argue that using IEPA for something like a massive fundamental restructuring of U.S. trade policy, essentially setting new taxes on imports, goes way beyond what that 1977 law was ever intended for.
So the constitutional argument is basically Congress's power of the purse.
Fundamentally, yes. Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution explicitly gives Congress the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises. The argument is that by using IEPA to impose these broad tariffs, the president is effectively usurping Congress's core constitutional power over taxation and trade.
And what's really striking here is who's lining up against the administration's position. It's not just the usual suspects.
No, that's what makes this so significant. You have Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski joining Democrats in filing an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief, arguing against this broad interpretation of presidential power under IEPA.
A Republican arguing against a Republican president's signature policy tool.
It shows that the concern here transcends partisanship. It's about the institutional balance of power between Congress and the executive branch. Senators like Murkowski are worried about the long-term precedent allowing any president to bypass Congress on major economic policy simply by declaring an emergency.
So the stakes in this Supreme Court ruling are enormous.
Absolutely huge. It could either rubber stamp a massive expansion of unilateral presidential power in the economic sphere, or it could deliver a major rebuke and reaffirm Congress's constitutional role. It directly relates to this dual-track presidency we mentioned.
Which is the perfect segue. While all this domestic chaos and these legal battles unfold, the executive branch is moving full steam ahead on the global stage. Completely different picture.
Totally different. Aggressive deal-making, projecting power, taking military action, all seemingly unimpeded by the paralysis back in Washington.
And the biggest example of that this week was the signing ceremony in Tokyo.
Yes. President Trump and Japanese Prime Minister Takeuchi Sano formally signed the framework agreement for what the administration is calling the new golden age for the U.S.-Japan alliance.
That sounds like more than just diplomatic language.
Oh, it is. This represents a huge strategic realignment, and it's underpinned by massive economic commitments from Japan, building on an earlier $550 billion pledge.
And where's that money specifically going? What's the focus?
It's heavily focused on bolstering U.S. infrastructure and technology, specifically aimed at creating an alternative to China's dominance in key areas. We're seeing up to $332 billion earmarked for U.S. energy infrastructure.
What kind of energy?
Advanced stuff. Small modular reactors, SMRs, new gas turbines, modernizing the U.S. grid. Then there's another $75 billion specifically for AI infrastructure, like data centers, and about $30 billion for critical electronics components and strengthening supply chains.
Building a sort of joint economic fortress, almost.
That's the idea.
Yeah.
And a crucial piece of that is tackling critical minerals.
Right. The rare earths and things needed for batteries, electronics.
Exactly. China currently dominates that market, controlling maybe 70% of global rare earth mining. This new agreement includes a major U.S.-Japan partnership to develop alternative sources, collaborating on mining, processing, refining. The goal is to break that dependency, build a secure supply chain outside of China's control.
And Japan is making concessions, too. It's not just Japanese money flowing to the U.S.
No, there are significant trade components. Japan agreed to accept U.S.-made cars that meet U.S. safety standards without requiring extra Japanese testing. That's a potentially big door opener for American automakers.
That's been a sticking point for years.
Decades. And maybe even more significantly, Toyota announced it's opening up its huge distribution network within Japan to U.S. automakers. That's unprecedented access.
Wow. Okay. And then there's the technology piece.
Yes, a formal U.S.-Japan technology prosperity deal. They signed a memorandum of cooperation covering the future.
Like what?
Things like jointly developing standards for 6G wireless, collaborating on quantum computing research, fusion energy, and even establishing shared ethical guidelines for artificial intelligence. It's a long-term play to ensure the U.S. and Japan lead in setting the standards for the next wave of technology, again, clearly aimed at competing with China.
So building alliances is one track. The other track seems to be aggressively using economic weapons against adversaries. Treasury Sanctions Office, OFAC, was busy.
Very busy. They hit Russia hard, sanctioning the country's two biggest energy companies, Rosneft and Lukoil, plus a bunch of their subsidiaries. The stated goal, to degrade the Kremlin's ability to raise revenue for its military.
And the real teeth in these sanctions often comes from the secondary sanctions threat, right? Explain that.
Right. Secondary sanctions are what make U.S. financial power truly global. It basically says, we're not just punishing Rosneft and Lukoil. We're telling every other bank or company in the world, in Europe, India, anywhere, that if they do significant business with these sanctioned Russian firms, they risk getting completely cut off from the U.S. dollar and the U.S. financial system.
So it forces global compliance with U.S. policy. Choose sides.
Essentially, yes. It extends U.S. economic leverage far beyond our borders. And then OFAC made an even more, frankly, shocking move.
Against Colombia.
Yes. Yeah. They sanctioned the sitting president of Colombia, Gustavo Petro, along with his wife, his son, and his interior minister, sanctioning the head of state of a major regional ally. That's almost unheard of.
What was the justification for such a drastic step?
The administration accused Petro of letting cocaine production in Colombia explode and claimed he was benefiting narco-terrorist organizations. It's a dramatic escalation, prioritizing the aggressive counter-drug agenda over long-standing diplomatic ties.
So diplomacy takes a backseat to direct economic punishment, even with an ally.
It seems so. It certainly sends a shockwave through Latin America and raises questions about the future of that alliance. But it delivers a very strong message about the administration's number one priority in the region.
And sticking with economic pressure, the U.S. Trade Representative also took action against China.
Yes, USTR launched a new Section 301 investigation. This one looks into whether China is actually sticking to the commitments it made in that Phase 1 trade deal from a few years back.
And launching an investigation like that, what does it signal?
It signals intent. It's basically putting China on notice right before President Trump is scheduled to meet with President Xi Jinping. It says, we're watching, we're not happy, and we're ready to impose more tariffs or other penalties if necessary. It's about maximizing leverage going into those talks.
Okay, so economic weapons are being deployed aggressively.
Right.
But the administration is also using kinetic force, actual military action, in this war on drugs.
Yes, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth confirmed more strikes. He announced that U.S. military forces hit four vessels described as drug smuggling boats in the Eastern Pacific Ocean the day before,
resulting in fatalities.
Yes, 14 people were killed in those strikes. That brings the total number of deaths in this campaign since it started back in September to 51 people killed across at least 13 different boat interdictions.
51 fatalities. I mean, calling it a war on drugs almost seems inadequate. That sounds like active naval combat.
The administration is deliberately blurring that line. Secretary Hegseth used very strong language, comparing the cartels to terrorist groups. He said, quote, these narco-terrorists have killed more Americans than Al-Qaeda, and they will be treated the same.
So framing it as counterterrorism justifies military force rather than law enforcement tactics.
That appears to be the strategy. And they're also being very careful, it seems, to avoid legal accountability for these actions.
How are they doing that?
Well, in this latest incident with the four boats, there was one survivor. Instead of detaining that person, which would raise all sorts of legally thorny questions about due process and detention rights under U.S. law.
What did they do?
They immediately handed the survivor over to Mexico's search and rescue authorities, essentially outsourcing the problem to avoid U.S. legal jurisdiction. It looks like a conscious strategy.
Yeah.
Use lethal force, minimize survivors, and avoid U.S. courts.
Operating in a legal gray area, basically.
Very dark gray area. And adding to this whole picture is the recent naval deployment.
The USS Gerald R. Ford carrier strike group moving into the Caribbean.
Exactly. Analysts widely see this not as a drug interdiction move. You don't send a carrier group for that, but as preparation for potential land-based strikes. The president has publicly said the land is going to be next. And Venezuela is broadly seen as the most likely target, given the administration's rhetoric. Deploying a full carrier strike group suggests they're serious about potential military intervention, possibly large scale, and again, without any apparent move to seek authorization from Congress.
It all fits that pattern, doesn't it? Domestic gridlock pushes the executive to act unilaterally, using the most expansive interpretations of presidential power, especially abroad.
Precisely. And that drive extends to reshaping the administrative state itself to better facilitate these goals. Look at the Department of Justice restructuring.
Right. They launched a whole new branch within the civil division.
Yes. The Enforcement and Affirmative Litigation Branch. It officially replaces what used to be the Consumer Protection Branch. That name change alone tells you a lot about the shift in mission.
So what is this new affirmative litigation section designed to do?
Its stated purpose is to proactively sue states, cities, or any other groups that the administration believes are interfering with or obstructing federal policies.
So if they can't get Congress to pass something or states push back, they'll sue them.
It looks like it. They're building an internal legal attack dog unit to enforce the administration's agenda through the courts when legislative or cooperative paths fail.
And the initial targets are very specific, very political.
Yep, extremely. The DOJ explicitly named two top priorities right out of the gate. First, suing jurisdictions with sanctuary laws that limit cooperation with federal immigration enforcement.
Okay, and the second?
Second, and I'm quoting here, protecting women and children from pharmaceutical companies, healthcare providers, and medical associations profiting off of false and misleading claims related to so-called gender transition.
So using federal lawsuits to fight culture war battles.
That's exactly what it appears to be, institutionalizing proactive litigation on highly charged social issues.
Now, even with the shutdown dragging on, you mentioned regulatory agencies are still active.
They are. It's surprising. But the Federal Register on October 28th alone published 8 new notices, 1 proposed rule, and 3 final rules, coming from 7 different agencies. The rulemaking machine keeps grinding, shut down or not.
Any significant rules finalized in that batch?
One notable one came from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB. They issued a final interpretive rule regarding the Fair Credit Reporting Act, FCRA.
And what does it do?
It significantly expands federal preemption, meaning it limits the ability of individual states to pass their own laws regulating what goes into credit reports if those laws are stricter than federal standards.
So it centralizes power in Washington and potentially weakens consumer protections in states that wanted to go further.
That's the effect, yes. It prevents states from being laboratories of democracy on credit reporting, essentially locking in the federal baseline.
We also saw changes announced for the military health program TRICARE.
Yes, the Department of Defense rolled out some changes for the 2026 calendar year, and it was a real mix, reflecting those competing pressures we see everywhere. On one hand, they eliminated all cost sharing for contraceptives for TRICARE beneficiaries, a move generally favored by Democrats.
Okay.
But in the very same announcement, they declared that TRICARE will no longer cover puberty blockers or hormone therapies for gender dysphoria for any beneficiary under the age of 18.
A major policy shift reflecting the administration's stance on gender issues.
Exactly. So you see administrative action being used to enact these highly polarized policies that are completely stalled in Congress. The executive branch just does it.
Let's shift gears slightly to the Pentagon itself. They're trying to fix a long-standing problem, getting new technology actually into the hands of soldiers.
Yeah, the defense acquisition process is notoriously slow and bureaucratic. There was a great quote from Keoki Jackson at the MITRE Corporation trying to describe it.
What did he say?
He said it's not just one valley of death where good ideas die between research and deployment. He called it a landscape littered with multiple ditches of death that strip the tires and destroy the transmission of promising new tech. Basically, the system itself breaks the innovation.
That's a vivid image. So what's the proposed fix?
MITRE has developed something called the Transition Maturity Framework. It builds on the old ways of measuring readiness.
Which were?
A primarily technology readiness level, TRL, how mature is the tech itself. And manufacturing readiness level, MRL, can we actually build it reliably?
Okay. What does the new framework add?
It adds 3 crucial new dimensions. Transition readiness level, and how ready is the bureaucracy to actually adopt this thing? Requirements readiness level, does it actually meet a real defined need? And maybe the most important one, warfighter readiness level or WRL?
Warfighter readiness level, what does that cover?
This gets at the practical stuff that often gets ignored. Does the soldier have the training to use it? Is the doctrine updated? Are the spare parts and logistics in place? Is there a user manual? It forces the system to think about the entire ecosystem needed for a new technology to actually be useful in the field, not just whether the gadget itself works.
Trying to make adoption systematic, not just based on luck or a champion pushing it through.
Exactly. Less random examples of success, more of a repeatable process.
Okay, one last area of administrative action. Federal cybersecurity. The EPA seems particularly focused on a vulnerable sector.
Yes. The water sector, water and wastewater treatment plants. The EPA is working directly with these utilities to help them find operational technology, the control systems that are exposed to the internet.
Why the focus there?
Because there's what the EPA calls a general lack of asset awareness in that sector. Many utilities, especially smaller ones, rely on outside vendors. They don't have dedicated IT staff, and they just don't know what parts of their critical systems are connected online and potentially vulnerable.
And this comes after a pretty alarming government report, didn't it?
It did. A 2024 Inspector General audit found critical cybersecurity vulnerabilities in nearly 100 drinking water systems. These systems served over 26 million people.
That's serious.
Very. So the EPA just released a new tool, a cybersecurity procurement checklist, to help utilities ask the right questions when they're buying new equipment or hiring vendors, trying to bake security in from the start.
And is there a broader shift in cybersecurity strategy across the federal government?
There seems to be. The buzzword is risk surface management, or RSM. The idea is to move beyond just reacting after you've been hacked, finding indicators of compromise.
To what?
To proactively identifying indicators of risk, or IRRs, trying to map out your vulnerabilities before they get exploited. There's also a big push to get all federal agencies speaking one language of risk, using common frameworks so they can actually coordinate and build large-scale resilience across the whole government.
Okay, so that covers the administrative state. The fragility is clear domestically, but let's end with that political bombshell, the investigation into the previous administration.
Right. House Oversight Committee Republicans dropped a major report, 91 pages, digging into former President Joe Biden's health and specifically his use of the AutoPen machine to sign documents, especially during the lame duck period after the election.
And this wasn't just a political report that landed with a thud. It had immediate legal consequences.
It did. The current Attorney General, Pam Bondi, announced almost immediately that her office has initiated a review specifically looking into the Biden administration's use of the AutoPen for signing presidential pardons.
What are the core allegations in the Republican report?
Several key claims. One, that Biden was increasingly shielded by his inner circle. Two, and this seems legally crucial, that staffers who operated the AutoPen, particularly for pardons, often did so without ever directly discussing the specific pardon decision with Biden himself.
Implying he wasn't actually making the decision.
That's the implication. The report also claims that the Justice Department under Biden had internally raised concerns about the overuse of the AutoPen on legally significant documents even years earlier.
And the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, took it a step further.
He did. He publicly asserted that any pardons signed only by AutoPen without direct presidential involvement in the decision are invalid on their face. His argument is that the pardon power constitutionally rests solely with the president and cannot be delegated even to an AutoPen operated by staff.
If that holds up legally, invalidating past pardons, that opens a massive legal can of worms.
Unprecedented territory. And of course, the counterargument came swiftly. Democrats dismissed the report as a partisan sham.
Their position.
They insist the former president was fully in charge, made every decision, and that using an AutoPen is just a mechanical act of signing, common practice for presidents. They also pivoted to questioning the current administration's transparency about health and its own use of AutoPens in the past. So it's become a fierce battle over history, legality, and political accountability.
What a day. Sam, when you step back, the contrast is just jarring. Domestic government grinding to a halt, SNAP benefits cut off, military pay in chaos, basic services faltering.
Total paralysis.
Yeah, at the exact same time, the executive branch is operating internationally with maximum force and speed. Huge new alliances, aggressive sanctions cutting off entire countries, actual military strikes racking up casualties.
The synthesis is really stark, isn't it? The administration seems to be maximizing its power where it has the most discretion. Foreign policy, military action, unilateral legal interpretations via the DOJ, while simultaneously allowing or even encouraging the domestic breakdown to use as political leverage.
It's like the government is being deliberately engineered to only function effectively when the president acts alone, outside of Congress.
And that really pushes the boundaries of executive authority, doesn't it?
It does. And that leads us to the real long-term question here.
Because the most significant actions we've discussed today, that new DOJ branch designed to sue states, the escalating military action against narco-terrorists without congressional debate, the Supreme Court battle over using IPA for massive tariff changes, they all fundamentally challenge the separation of powers.
So here's the final provocative thought we want to leave you with. If these broad interpretations of presidential power become accepted precedent, if a president can unilaterally impose massive tariffs by declaring an emergency, if they can wage undeclared lethal campaigns against non-state actors abroad, if they can create a Justice Department division specifically to sue states that resist federal policy,
then what real constitutional limits are left? What power does Congress retain to effectively check the executive branch in the future? And this isn't just about one president or one party.
The precedents being set now could reshape the power dynamic for generations.
Something to definitely keep thinking about.
Indeed. Thank you for walking us through that mountain of information today.
My pleasure. It was a lot.
It certainly was. And thank you for joining us on The Deep Dive. We'll see you next time.